One of the things that I really enjoy about A Question of Balance is that we tend to have follow-up stories with semi-regular guests, so we keep track of where they're going with their research. We're joined today by Dr. Andrea Lee, who's a senior lecturer at the University of Technology, Sydney, and she's been working on leaves and the effects of temperature. That's been a long-standing project for you, Andrea, and you seem to spend an awful lot of your time out in deserts. How's it all going?
Going really well. We're doing some really exciting work with how plants withstand extreme high temperatures. And people in my lab are interested in those extremes, not just averages. So if you think about the way that the climate is changing and when people are talking about climate change, they're often talking about an average increase in temperature by X degrees. But it's actually the extremes that we're most interested in. Heat waves, I suppose, are not only shown to be more frequent, more intense, but they're predicted to be yet more so in the future. And it's those extreme events that are likely to drive the evolution of new species, if you like, or even determine which species will adapt and survive. So these extreme high temperature events are of interest to desert plants where I'm working, because those plants are already living on the extreme edge of what's biologically able to be tolerated.
Now, Andrea, in a previous talk, you did talk about the thickness of leaves and also the shape of leaves and how this was so important in the way different plants were adapted to be able to withstand, amongst other things, temperature extremes.
Yeah, that's right. The shape and thickness, the morphology, which is the fancy word that we use, of leaves make a really, really marked difference in their ability to cope with really high temperatures. Also, the degree to which they're reflective. So if you go out into these arid and semi-arid regions, which, by the way, cover like 2/3 of our continent, so pretty important. And we go out to those places, you'll notice that a large proportion of the species out there have very hairy, pale leaves. They're covered in white hairs or waxy coatings, and those help to reflect radiation that's otherwise going to cook the leaf inside. But some leaves, the morphology doesn't necessarily lend itself to avoiding high temperatures. And for those leaves, we're really interested in the physiology, what's going on underneath. Physiology of humans is, you know, blood pressure or gastrointestinal workings. For a plant, it's the photosynthetic equipment, the bits of machinery that actually carry out photosynthesis, that fix light and convert it to energy. That's the part of the plant that's really important. And so using physiological methods now, people in my lab are beginning to get a sense of a threshold between where heat damage actually occurs, the photosynthetic machinery that is irreparable, versus damage that can be repaired and the leaf can live another day.
Are you saying that there is kind of an optimal temperature at which the various biochemical reactions that make up photosynthesis can occur, and if you go too high, you are starting to break down this? I guess a bit like corals, and their little organisms can't survive when the water becomes too hot because their biochemistry starts to get affected negatively.
That's exactly what I'm saying. There's a threshold, an optimal temperature, as you say, or what we're calling it is a thermal damage threshold above which a plant is really no longer viable. And there's a whole lot of sort of mechanisms that contribute to that. What we're finding in our lab is not only is there a unique threshold for a given species, so a certain species of saltbush, perhaps Atroplex vesicaria, might have a thermal tolerance threshold of 47 degrees, and a species of Triodia, otherwise known as Spinifex or hummock grass, that might have a thermal damage threshold of 50 degrees. What we're finding is that it's not just that each species has a unique thermal damage threshold, but that thermal damage threshold changes through space and time. It really complicates things.
What do you mean by that, that it changes this space and time?
Let's just take time as an example. If you think about yourself as a human, if you have a 35 degree day in February in Sydney, you're pretty okay with that. It feels hot, but you're able to cope with it because your body has become used to hot temperatures. If you have a 35 degree day in September in spring, you feel like you're going to die. What we're finding is that plants have a similar, what we're calling acclimatization response. They acclimatize to a certain temperature. So with the plants that we're looking at, and I have a fantastic PhD student, Ellen Curtis, who's been doing a lot of this work, and what she's been finding is that for up to 40 species that she's measured throughout the year, she puts them in little torture chambers in our field lab over at the Australian Arid Lands Botanic Gardens in Port Augusta. She puts her particular species into a torture chamber of 47 degrees in summer. It's okay, but if she puts it in the same temperature in spring, it's not okay. But the thermal damage threshold is shifting upwards through time from winter to summer. But that shift is also unique for each species. So that's how it shifts in time.
Is that related to maybe other changes in the leaves or the plants? I mean, do they get a thicker outer layer or some changes in their morphology on the outside in that really hot part of the year, but it's kind of thinned down in the cooler? I guess the bad analogy would be that humans get a good brown coating of suntan in summer and they don't get burnt so easily, whereas in winter they'd be fried from one day of that amount of sun.
I like the analogy. It's a good one. Actually, we're finding that it's not really very closely related to the morphology or shape and size of leaves, but more related, at this stage we're still suspecting, and there's more work that we're going to be doing on this, but it's much more related to biochemical processes. So every organism has the ability to produce heat shock proteins. They're little tiny proteins that get turned on by the genes. They get upregulated and they help, in this case, the physiology of a leaf cope. So when any organism experiences really high temperatures, proteins in their body denature, they unravel. And heat shock proteins are special proteins that have lots of functions, but one of them is to lock onto those proteins and to stop them unraveling or to refold them if they do unravel. So heat shock proteins get increasingly upregulated in this process of acclimatization. So throughout the year, the more exposed they get to sort of gradually hotter temperatures and hotter temperatures, the more of these heat shock proteins that they produce. And this is that's a very crude explanation, and we're going to be looking in much more detail at this, but that's basically what's going on. But if you think about the implications for that, if producing more of these heat shock proteins requires just a gradual introduction to gradually hotter conditions, but suddenly you have a rogue heat wave in the middle of spring, before you've managed to upregulate these proteins, then it's not going to be a happy story for you. So that's why we're particularly interested in this upregulation through time and what implications that might have.
That does raise in my mind a question. If we're going to gradually have a generally hotter climate with all these other events going on, does that mean that you would suspect that plants will develop more of these heat shock proteins to cope with an increase in the baseline temperature of their environment with climate change?
Definitely a possibility. I guess one of the things that we're really interested in, and I have another PhD student just starting to work on this now, is the idea that it's not a bottomless pit. Like humans, like everybody, plants have limited resources, and especially in Australia, the soil nutrients available to plants are very poor. We have very, very low nutrient soils, particularly in the semi-arid regions and arid regions of Australia. And it's those nutrients that you need to put towards building your physiological processes. So the production of heat shock proteins, for example, is costly. You don't have an endless supply of them. So otherwise, why would plants shift their thresholds up? during the year. Why wouldn't they just keep them up all the time? Well, there has to be a trade-off. Otherwise, you would. You would just walk around with your optimal protection all the time. So there has to be some kind of trade-off, and it's this sort of trade-off that we're starting to investigate next. But it's a very good question. You know, how much can a plant upregulate? Ultimately, it can't go on upregulating because there's a certain temperature above which nothing can survive. So it's not an endless uphill battle, if you like.
Something that is coming through again and again with the various plant people that I do talk with is this fact that all of these complex substances that plants use for all sorts of things, be it nectar, be it pollen, be it defences to stop animals eating them, they are all costly in terms of the amount of energy required to make them. You're saying the same thing again. And every time it comes down to the fact the plants can't get up and walk away and just find a new source of resources to use. They are limited, and we do have such poor soil.
Exactly. And I guess it's understanding those sorts of trade-offs that they have to make, which is going to help us understand also which species are more likely to be vulnerable versus more resilient. And particularly in these regions where you might have one or two species that are really widespread, mulga, for example, that's Acacia annua. I mean, if you haven't been out into those regions, you wouldn't know it. But for those who have, it's all across Australia. You know, is there anything about its ability to find nutrients that is helping it better survive these harsh environments? Perhaps that's something up its sleeve that we don't know about.
In many ways, this is a slow doom and gloom story, Andrea. Once again, it's sort of waving the flag and saying, what are we going to do about climate change to try to keep ecosystems at least functional? Or am I being glass half empty?
I am more of a glass half full person. I guess I always step back and think the world will bounce back long after we've done what we need to do to it. I do think in the immediate future, though, there is a risk of losing species, and I'm really keen to understand not just even losing them, but even seeing a redistribution. And I'm interested to understand what might be driving that. So temperature is where I'm coming from, but you could get really depressed about it. I find it fascinating more than that, and we do see instances of adaptation that are much faster than we would have predicted. But we're also seeing other instances where species are being wiped out a lot faster than we had even been aware of. So
we're only talking plants here. They're usually somewhere down in the food chain. What about all those organisms of different sizes and varieties that ultimately are going to somehow or other be relying on the plant life to survive?
Terrestrial plants are responsible for keeping everything else alive, pretty much, in a whole lot of ways. And even losing a given species of plant in itself might not be a sad or bad thing, but if we think about the species diversity reducing, if there is a group of species dying out, perhaps there might be, you know, I don't know, but perhaps annual species might be more likely to die out, or a certain set of grasses that only flower in the spring or what have you, then what is that doing for the diversity of the animals that depend on them? The structural diversity, the supply of seed. Yeah, there's knock-on effects that are rather unthinkable.
Andrew, you said both time and space. We've talked about time. What about space?
Yeah, so these thermal thresholds that change through time, we're also finding that where plants are most likely to grow can make a difference. So let's take a really pared-back version of this. One of the things that helps plants cope with temperature the most is their ability to sweat, if you like, the way humans do. We call it transpiration.
I do think it's so much nicer a term. I'll just go and transpire a little.
It's much more dainty. Men sweat, plants transpire. So plants have little holes on the bottom of their leaves, and they take in carbon dioxide and they lose water. But the water comes out as water vapor, and that's the process of transpiration. It's basically water evaporating out of leaves. And in that process, the way I liken it to sweating is we all know that sweating helps us cool as humans. We basically lose heat through the water that comes out of our pores. Well, plants, it's exactly the same. Plants can transpire all they like as if their feet are wet. If their roots are in accessing water, they can keep those little holes, those stomata, open on their leaves, and they can keep transpiring and losing heat and cooling very, very effectively. But they will close those pores and stop transpiring if water is lacking, i.e. in a drought situation. So in these deserts, it's not uncommon for plants, particularly in higher areas like a sand dune or a rocky slope, to close their stomata for a very, very long period. And if they've got their stomata closed, they can't transpire, they can't cool, and they're potentially much more vulnerable to heat stress. So if you keep in mind here, water stress makes heat stress worse. And then think about how in the desert, there are plants that are adapted to areas with less water and plants that are adapted to areas with slightly more water. And it might look all the same to the untrained eye, but if you look at a riverbed or a floodplain, there may not be water there now. But the plants living there are adapted to coping with water. They're more likely to have their stomata open. So those plants in those areas, the riverbeds and the floodplains, have a lower thermal damage threshold. That is, they can't cope with heat stress as well as plants that are adapted, naturally adapted to a sand dune or a rocky hill slope. So not only are these thresholds changing in among species and changing in time, but they also are dependent quite a lot actually on whether a plant is naturally adapted to access more or less water.
Well, that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, it was what we were predicting. But it hadn't been shown before, and we were pretty excited to find it, actually.
Yes, I suppose that is another example of we think we know something, but nobody's ever got down to measuring it.
Exactly, yeah. So I guess the thing that's really uppermost in our mind with all of these findings over the last couple of years is that people who are modelling vegetation responses to climate change, if they happen to incorporate temperature into their models, they might plug in a single number for temperature stress. They might call it 47 degrees in a desert environment or 38 degrees in a coastal environment. But what we're showing is that that's actually not going to cut the mustard because it's going to depend not only on the species, it's going to depend on the time of year, and it's also going to depend on the microhabitat that that plant is naturally adapted to.
I guess it's like our economic modelling too, isn't it? One size definitely does not fit all. I can see that it's absolutely essential that we do have this accurate and carefully collected data, because otherwise our models are just going to be wrong.
That's right. And a lot of people argue, and I mostly agree, that a model is better than no model. And models are being refined all the time, and we're getting many parameters, and the accuracy of these parameters, the parameters being, you know, temperature or whatever it is, are being refined all the time. So I think we're always getting steps closer, but I think it's important to recognize that sometimes there's some really big variations in the sorts of things you might plug into the model that need to be accounted for.
Andrea, I was talking to another guest who said that many plants are economical in relation to flowers because making flowers and nectar is a very energy intensive process, and they suck back into their phloem and tissues nutrients, these resources that are no longer needed, and that's why you end up with just a shriveled little brown flower residue. What happens with the leaves and things on your plants out there in the desert?
Well, that's exactly what happens with the leaves as well. They pull all the nutrients back into the plant before they drop the leaves. If you contrast that to deciduous species, that's species that drop their leaves every winter, like the ones from the northern hemisphere, like an oak tree or what have you, they have lots of nutrients in a lot of their soils there, and they can just produce new leaves the following year, no big deal. Whereas in Australia, because the nutrients are so scarce, they certainly do what you just described. They pull the nutrients in when they drop the leaves, but they drop the leaves less often. So they will hang on to them longer. They will often hang on to them for several years, and they will build leaves to last. They'll make them structurally stronger, so they won't get eaten by herbivores as much. They won't be subject to wind damage and what have you. They'll hang on to these really tough, structurally strong leaves for longer. What this does is helps to at least redress the balance a little bit with respect to conserving the very few nutrients in the soil.
Yes, as we decided in the story with another guest, we decided that plants were actually reusers and recyclers.
That's great. I love it.
Now, I want to ask you one thing. Certainly it is very hot in the desert, but also at night it is very cold. That means you have these plants that have to deal with horribly high temperatures in the daytime, but how do they manage to cope with the cold stuff at night?
You're absolutely right, and this is a question that keeps me up at night. The variation that plants have to put up with in the desert is absolutely extreme. I mean, in alpine regions, they do have to put up with some pretty extreme temperature variations, but the high temperatures are not the same. In the desert, you can have 35-degree change in a single day. It can go down to zero and up to 35, you know, in late winter. I don't know how they're coping with low temperatures, and that's definitely an area that I'm looking into investigating. I think that plants having to deal with these real extremes have to be pretty special. I'm even interested to know whether the same mechanisms, I'd say a lot of the time that the mechanisms are the same. Several of these heat shock proteins or heat shock-like proteins are just basically stress proteins. They're just going to help stop the protein unfolding. So similar mechanisms might also be at play for cold tolerance. But at this stage, I haven't looked at that with my plants, and I'm definitely keen to.
Well, apart from the fact that now you can be working on the heat during the day and the cold at night, where do you think you're going to get to in the next 12 months with your research?
Well, I'm certainly keen to look at the aspect of nutrients and how being low in nutrients might affect your ability to cope with heat stress. And I have a PhD student, Kirsty Milner, starting on that this year. And another aspect that we're looking at, and another PhD student, Alicia Cook, is going to be looking at this, is how heat stress affects very, very young plants. The seedlings that are just germinating and how they cope is actually critical, because if you happen to have a heat wave in the middle of spring when there's a mass germination event going and the plants are trying to grow, you know, what's going to happen there? And the other area that we're really looking at is recovery from stress. So if you have two heat stress events in a short period of time, how much time in between those heat stress events do you need to repair the damage that's happened to the photosynthetic equipment? You know, you and I both need time to recover when we get the flu or whatever. It's our physiology, it's our immune system kicking in. Well, similar sorts of processes are having to happen in plants. And how many heat stress events is going to knock you on the head? It might not be that a stress event is a kill event, but if you have two sort of sublethal events that happen in short succession, maybe that's going to tip you over the edge. So they're all aspects that we're investigating in the next couple of years.
Well, it sounds like you've got a really exciting little group of PhD students there, which is wonderful, because there's nothing better than having colleagues that you can toss your ideas around with. Thank you so much, Andrea. It's lovely to catch up and to discover all these new things about plants that live in such extreme conditions.